From 90.5 WESA, this is The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gap. 100,000 Pittsburgh residents were under a boil water advisory this week due to erratic chlorine levels.
We're doing this, again, out of an abundance of caution, not because there's 34 things that we're concerned about. We're only concerned about one, and that was the chlorination.
It was the latest in a series of challenges for the Water and Sewer Authority, including lead levels in water. Did mold on linen supplied by a laundry facility to UPMC lead to the deaths of transplant patients? Also, Governor Wolf unveils his new budget plan Tuesday with a focus on streamlining costs.
This is not the traditional kind of thing where we're just slashing and burning our way to a balanced budget. We're actually trying to make government work better.
Our weekly news roundup, The Confluence, follows this news update. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. New information was revealed from a private report about how transplant patients in Pittsburgh contracted mold infections. Would that lead to further investigations by the CDC and the Pennsylvania Department of Health? But first, Thursday, shortly before noon, a flush and boil water advisory affecting about 100,000 Pittsburghers was lifted after nearly 48 hours. The problem, chlorine. This was the latest in a series of challenges, issues for the Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority. Joining us in studio to talk about that, Natasha Lindstrom, reporter for the Tribune Review. Welcome, Natasha.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And also in studio, Liz Reed, health and science reporter for WESA. Welcome, Liz.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
If you have a question, you can tweet us at WESA Confluence. So at Thursday's news conference, the interim director for construction and engineering, Bob Weimer, said the problem was how long the water was exposed to chlorine.
You put chlorine into the water, and it needs a certain amount of time to do its job. And we were short by a certain amount of time in a few locations, not throughout the area, in a few locations.
Okay, chlorine added as a disinfectant to kill pathogens. Natasha, let's get a little background on this first. The water was from the Highland Park Reservoir. So Weimer saying the water wasn't exposed long enough to the chlorine for it to do its job, sort of?
Yes, and that is what they clarified yesterday was the true primary reason for the order that was put out on Tuesday afternoon. It stemmed originally from a review that the state was doing into PWSA. They said, in early January. It was on January 20th that they requested more information, and the 24th that they met again requesting more detailed information because they found some, what started as an erratic reading, what they called was outside of the plant. That was the first thing that made headlines and news because that was the first thing they told us about and what did spur the review. However, that was more of a technical issue. That kilometer has since been corrected. And what they explained yesterday was that the real problem was what they call with this log removals, which is, like as you said, the amount of time the chlorine stays in contact with the water from when it gets from without the plant to when it reaches the first customer who drinks it. And they had thought that it was taking 1 to 2 hours to reach the first customer. And even PWSA officials said they were surprised to learn it was actually taking only 40 to 55 minutes. And they said that put them about 25% off of what the state standard is. So they do want to make some adjustments there. They emphasized again and again, city as well as PWSA officials, that they never fell out of compliance with federal standards, but they fell short of meeting the Pennsylvania's Safe Drinking Water Act.
So is that a flow issue, a pumping issue about the contact and it's getting to the customer too soon before the chlorine does its job?
Exactly. And they said part of the reasons for that is because they did some of these initial calculations years ago. And since then, there's been a lot of changes in the pipe systems and the amount of customers using them or things happening. So that can all affect the flow. And so they're working on, they said there's still about 5 or 6 points that are of these major transmission pipes that are on the cusp of not meeting that log removal requirement. So rather than having to just pump more chlorine in to do that, they're trying to figure out how to adjust that flow to get that to a longer duration in touch with chlorine before it reaches customers.
A little more background. So it was the DEP. Now, did the DEP order PWSA to issue the advisory?
Yes, that happened on Tuesday afternoon. And that was what obviously caused all the disruption for the people of Pittsburgh. It's what caused the mayor and his chief of staff, Kevin Ackland, to accuse the state regulators of holding them hostage, a third of the city hostage, because they continued to argue that this, that if we were in any other state, we wouldn't have been closing the schools. We would still have been drinking the water. They still might have had to adjust some things, but they kind of downplayed it. They said, hey, DEP does have a job to do as a regulator. And it should be noted, DEP has cited the PWSA for a number of violations in the past as well. So, it's their job to make sure they're in line.
I guess at first consideration, we just say, oh, it affects my house, or it doesn't affect my house, but I knew somebody in one of the affected neighborhoods. That's, too bad. They're going to have to do this. But the impact, you're talking, potential for hospitals, schools, 24 schools, I believe, were closed for a day. Restaurants, a lot of businesses and schools were affected as well.
They did. And I spent the first day of the audit Wednesday, kind of actually visiting different businesses in the affected areas, which stemmed, from the Hill District all the way to the way eastern ends of the city. In Squirrel Hill, for instance, a lot of the corporate chains like Jimmy John's and Starbucks were closed, where some independent restaurant owners or coffee shop owners figured out how to get by. One coffee shop was making serving espresso, but not drip coffee or pour overs because it wasn't hot enough, to meet the boil requirements. Things like that, but it definitely did disrupt some businesses, and a lot of people, and made for a hassle. Some people had to rush to the different water distribution stations set up by the city to get bottled water or water from the Buffaloes.
Okay, one more question about this, and then I want to move on to some of the ongoing issues and bring Liz into the conversation as well. And that is, Mayor Peduta was at the news conference yesterday when the lift was announced, and he said never was there a danger. They said there was never bacteria. Is that comforting enough, or have you talked to people saying, do I trust PWSA?
Well, certainly, I think a lot of just the problems we've seen nationally in terms of the public water, people want to make sure it's safe. But his point was that it wasn't, they didn't put this order in because they found some kind of bacteria. There was just they saw that there was some deficiencies in the chlorine operating system to where they saw there may have been a potential for it. But they said 33 hours of flushing leading up to them lifting the order proved their water was absolutely fine. The city actually released a bunch of fire hydrants to do so. And basically the DEP lifting the order confirms that the water is safe and acceptable for public use. As you mentioned, some of the other challenges, I think it's important to point out, just because this one order was lifted, it was a small piece of good news yesterday, but the tone was also kind of somber at the press conference yesterday, as Director Lindstrom, touched on morale as well as the capabilities of PWSA being at an all-time low. He said one of the next crises or big challenges they need to address, maybe not crises, is the lead problems in our city, including how the old glut of housing contributes to that. It's part of what made this a flush and boil order and not just a boil order because of the old lead pipes that we deal with in the city. They're also grappling with debt approaching $1 billion and a lot of other billing issues and challenges in the past. So maybe Liz can get into more of what's coming up next for them, but they have a lot going on right now that they need to address.
And the lead, whereas this particular issue with the chlorine was an incident that started and supposedly has been resolved now, the lead, Liz, is an ongoing issue that they're trying to address and correct.
That's right, and I think it's interesting that you shared that Mr. Lindstrom had said morale among staff at PWSA is low. Excuse me for my voice, I've been under the weather, but I think the same could be said about morale among customers. I've spent the last few weeks meeting with a lot of different customers, specifically around their lead testing results. And in a word, people are frustrated. The overwhelming feeling that I got is people aren't sure if they can trust what PWSA is telling them.
So, this frustration, how it was expressed, Was it just people coming together, gathering together, or were these at official meetings hosted by PWSA?
So I was at the PWSA meeting. PWSA has been hosting a series of meetings since, I believe, October is when they started it. They said these meetings are not state mandated, but the state did mandate that they provide information to the public. So this is one of the ways that they're going about it by holding these meetings. You know, to their credit, the meeting I went to in Lawrenceville, they stayed for over 3 hours. They answered every single question that was asked, or they were there long enough to so that everyone could ask their question, I should say. And yeah, the meeting I went to in Lawrenceville was one of the longest, according to their PR folks. And according to someone who had been to another meeting, it was also the most contentious or among the most contentious. The people that were at that meeting, in my view, were very informed and they asked a lot of questions. Like, for example, people asked about Veolia and the relationship PWSA has with Veolia, which is a private company, which is accused of changing the anti-corrosion material without state approval. And PWSA is now in arbitration with Veolia. But like a resident brought up Veolia. And then in the very next meeting, which I believe was in Mount Washington or in a southern part of the city, they went ahead and added Veolia in as part of their presentation, rather than, you know, have to have a resident bring it up.
We are talking about water issues in the city of Pittsburgh on the Confluence. Our guests are Liz Reed, health and science reporter for WESA, and Natasha Lindstrom, reporter for the Tribune Review. Mentioned Veolia, and that came up at yesterday's news briefing, Natasha. Veolia, of course, was the private firm contracted for, what were they, about 2 years or so?
To 3 years.
3 years, yeah. to run basically the water operations, correct?
Correct. I think from about 2012 to 2015, if I recall. And the city, it did come up yesterday. So the entire city council has requested that the state auditor general as well as the state attorney general do a full audit and or review or investigation, thorough investigation into PWSA in terms of its outside contractors, specifically citing Veolia. And so that was brought up at the press conference. Kevin Ackland, chief of staff to Mayor Bill Peduto, you know, was quick to say, hey, you know, we have a lawsuit against them. We filed in October. We're in arbitration with them. We agree. And one of the things he said was that the contract that they had in place may incentivize savings. And in doing so, he said they believe that that may have incentivized them to not invest in ways that they should have been. And as Peduto has called it, he said there's been well over a decade of disinvestment in the authority. Right now, then they have so much debt to high debt load. He says about 50 cents of every dollar customers pay is going to debt alone.
50 cents of every dollar. Debt alone.
I should mention, too, with Veolia and that last June, the Michigan Attorney General filed a lawsuit against Veolia for, you know, alleging that they were partially responsible for the water crisis in Flint. So Veolia is not only facing arbitration or, you know, a lawsuit from PWSA.
Okay. So that brings us to what was being done and what is being done now to address the lead issue, both everything from maybe speeding up and verifying the test results to the actual addressing the problem?
Well, you know, they're doing these public meetings, for example, and they're encouraging, you know, I suppose the more immediate Band-Aid, they're encouraging people to flush their pipes, which the amount of time you need to flush depends on how long your service line is. So if it's 6 feet long, you don't have to flush as long as if, your house is 40 feet set back from the water main. They want people to flush. They want people to buy filters if you're concerned or if you have elevated lead levels. And they want people to consider replacing, you know, lead pipes in their home, lead service lines, pipes with lead solder, things like that.
Lines. What are those, Liz?
Okay, so the service line. So there's actually two parts of your service line. There's if you think about your street, there's like a water main that runs down your street, right?
Right.
And then there's a service line that goes directly to your house.
And who's responsible for that?
Well, it's not an easy question to answer because from the water main to the curb, There's a little thing called a curb stop. That's where they would turn off water service to your house, say, if you weren't paying your bill. From the water main to the curb is PWSA's responsibility. From the curb to your house is your responsibility.
And which can be quite expensive.
I've heard $20,000 from one Lawrenceville resident who did that. And the most expensive part is not actually replacing the line. It's the excavation. It's redoing the sidewalk, pouring that concrete. It's things like that.
Okay. Councilwoman Teresa Kale Smith said earlier, posed the idea that maybe PWSA should be disbanded, and the mayor commented on that earlier.
That's one option. The other option is partnering with other organizations in separating out the water side from the sewer side and being able to deal with our combined sewer overflow independently of water. We, as a government, can't sell water. We're not permitted to do so. But if we were to partner with a private company, we could sell water and use the revenue to fix the system.
Okay. Natasha, did that idea even come up at yesterday's news briefing?
It did a little bit towards the end. The mayor mentioned that he is ready to go out to put an RFP, a request for proposals, out. He was a little bit vague in terms of just exactly what model this would take. But I guess the RFP would be for actually some professional guidance maybe or partners who want to figure out what these new models would look like. He mentioned they do not want it to just a private operator take over like in the case of Viola did. They do not want to go back to that model. But he did mention alluding to, hey, if we can get over some of these boundaries we have among all the municipalities in this area. I mean, there's 130 in Allegheny County alone. Maybe there are opportunities to expand, as he mentioned there, maybe expand water delivery or something, or, you know, find other revenue generating options for the system, since he says as it stands now, it's just not sustainable.
Okay. In our 1 minute remaining, what is next regarding addressing the lead issue? This has been, let's face it, people are scared. They got very scared when they heard about the Flint crisis. Liz?
So, PWSA has been replacing lead service lines. The lead service lines that they own, not the ones that customers own, has been replacing those for years. They say they are going to ramp up those replacements. I believe maybe you remember the number, 1,500 by July, I feel like, was a number that was recently in the news. So they're really going to ramp up. They're under DEP order to replace 7% per year, and they've actually, according to Mr. Weimer, had been falling behind on that. But really, honestly, the long-term solution is to get the lead pipes out of the system, both on the public side and the private side. And the issue on the private side is that it's expensive and your average homeowner just can't afford it. And right now there's not a lot, at least locally, in terms of assistance for those homeowners.
Liz Reed is health and science reporter for WESA. Natasha Lindstrom, reporter for the Tribune Review. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Were hospital linens the source of mold that caused deadly infections in transplant patients? That's next on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Coming up a little later in the program, Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf presents his new budget to the legislature Tuesday. He said it'll be streamlined, but won't reveal if it'll be more or less than the current spending plan. But first, five transplant patients at UPMC Montefiore and Presbyterian contracted mold infections and died between October 2014 and July 2016. But where did the mold originate? The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention investigated and did not make a definitive finding. But an internal UPMC report, which became part of a civil lawsuit last week, might very well point to the source of the mold. Joining us in studio are two reporters who have been investigating this story as it's developed over the last couple of years. Ben Schmidt is a reporter for the Tribune Review. Welcome, Ben.
Thanks for having me.
And Sean Hamill's a reporter for the Post-Gazette. Welcome back to the show, Sean.
Glad to be here.
So let's get some background for what we do know. Is everybody on board with five now? Because I know earlier on there was some question or denial, well, this one patient, I believe Daniel Krieg, died from pneumonia, the hospital said. Is everybody on board that five have died from mold infection? We'll start with you, Ben.
Well, no, not everybody's on board. the attorney side, yes, it's five. UPMC, they don't really admit, or however you want to put it, they don't believe that mold caused his death. The autopsy does indicate that he had mold on a lobe of his lung that was removed when the autopsy was performed. So that's kind of being debated in court.
And so the admission is strictly because of lawsuit. We don't want to admit anything because the lawsuit?
Well, it's not unlike what many of your listeners will remember because it's still ongoing. We just had a story related to it. The four-year-old now VA Legionnaires outbreak.
Oh, yeah.
This is the very same issue at the heart of that dispute in the beginning and even till now. The VA never admitted that these patients died from Legionnaires, even though all their attorneys, all their family members said they went in walking. They never came out, only after they contracted Legionnaires. And the families in this case have told both Ben and I the same thing. They were recovering and all seemed to be going well until they contracted a mold infection.
Do we know if any other patients were infected and survived?
We don't know that. That's a really good question. And I say that only because the CDC did do a case review and they say there were no other patients that had hospital-acquired infections within the time period that you're talking about. They went back 18 months to the first one in 2014. And they looked at cases in between. And here's the caveat. They only looked at the hospitals where there were already cases. And this kind of brings it forward. So they only looked at Presbyterian Montefiore transplant patients because there are other issues that we can discuss that pointed to that being the source, that maybe it was one room, a negative pressure room. That was the original focus of that investigation because now it may seem coincidental, but at the time it seemed like really obvious to the CDC investigators as well as UPMC that, hey, four of those five patients, correct? I believe
three of the five
patients stayed in the exact same negative pressure room. And negative pressure is a room that somebody who's already got an infectious disease, they want to prevent other people from getting sick, that it prevents things from the outside coming in. So it's got a kind of a vacuum pressure if you open the door. And the theory was that it would potentially have sucked in when somebody left the door open this infection to somebody who didn't prior have an infection. These people did not have an infection. They were just recovering from a transplant. So that was the finding in the CDC study. That was UPMC's belief. And now we're not so sure.
Ben.
And the CDC, in short, in summary, said, don't do that anymore. Don't house those patients in negative pressure rooms. And UPMC agreed. So you had that going on, and you thought, well, at the time there were four deaths that we knew about and three out of the four. Now there's five. And three out of the four were in that room. And so we were sort of told that, well, the fourth one at Montefiore, that was a coincidence. They somehow contracted mold. Now there's another one, Daniel Craig, who is at Montefiore. And you start to wonder. And I think that's why the attorneys started digging into, were there other reports? Were there other things? And lo and behold, this other report surfaced about the linen supplier.
That brings us to the linen supplier and who investigated that. UPMC hired their own expert by the name of Andrew Streifel?
That's correct.
Why did they do that?
Well, I think early on when they hired him, and I actually believe Sean reported this early on, they made a big deal about it. Like, this guy's an expert. This guy knows mold. This guy's been around for years doing this. And they hired him, and I think Sean reported it. I might have mentioned it once or twice, and then we really didn't hear about him again. And what was going on that we didn't know about was that he was doing investigations. He was doing testing. And the results of his testing didn't surface until this civil lawsuit was filed last week.
Okay, Streifel is a hospital environmental specialist with the University of Minnesota. And so, Sean, he did this, but he just didn't stop at the hospital.
He didn't, and that's key. And what's so interesting about this and the way that this evolved. So Ben and I probably did the same things. When this story came out, Ben broke it at the Trib. And then I'm following Ben, and I'm looking for, well, what can I bring to the story? So I start calling everybody in town who does remediation for mold. I'm calling an infectious specialist. I called probably 20 people the first day that story broke. Half of those people said, you know who you need to talk to? Andy Streifel. I didn't know that UPMC had hired him, but everybody seems to acknowledge this is the guy, when you have a problem on the ground and you want to figure out what went wrong, you call him and you hire him to come out. So I called him, not knowing eventually he'd be hired by UPMC or had been. And he talked very freely at the time. And he said, yeah, I know about what you're talking about because I was at UPMC when they were deconstructing buildings outside Presby earlier in the year. And I've been following what's going on. He said, based on what I've seen reported already about the first three cases, he said, this is way back in September 2015, he said, based on what I know, because these were surface infections that went into the body, I think it's linens. I looked into that. I called Paris Healthcare, then the supplier of laundry. I said, hey, do you guys have any issues with this? They sent me and Ben the same stock statement saying, no, there's no problem here. And again, we didn't hear much more about it because then the focus became the negative pressure rooms. And then lo and behold, last week it shows up in this civil suit that after Andy Streifel was brought out by UPMC a second time in the fall of 2015, he did a standard investigation in the hospital. But later, these documents say, and the attorneys say, UPMC said, hey, let's take a look at the linens. He didn't look at it the first time, even though that's what he thought it was. So the next time he comes back in February of 2016, so about 5 months later, and he not only looks at the linens in the hospital, the report in the lawsuit says he reached into a freshly clean truckload full of linens, pulled out one that was damp to the touch, and analyzed, and he found lots and lots of mold on it. Then he also went to the laundry facility in Du Bois, where they do something like 20 million pounds. I forget what that is. It was an astronomical number. It was huge. They service 180 hospitals in Pennsylvania, New York, and maybe even into Ohio at this one facility. And he found the exact same kind of mold on the roof in these ducts where they were sucking in fresh air to cool the linens once they were washed. Found the same mold that had been found in not all of the patients, what they call rhizopus, which is a mucormycosis fungal.
Mold.
Yeah, mold. Right. Yeah, to get technical. We didn't know about this. Nobody knew about this until it showed up in the lawsuit and Ben reported it last week. And then I dug it out of the lawsuit too. And I was stunned, not because of what it necessarily found, but because it was exactly what Andy Streifel said he thought the cause was originally. So the first question everybody had was, now what? They're going to reinvestigate, right? That's not what they told us.
It's the confluence where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. We are talking with Sean Hamill, reporter for the Post-Gazette, Ben Schmidt, reporter for the Tribune Review, about mold infection deaths of some transplant patients at UPMC, Montefiore, and Presbyterian, with new information that came to light last week. Now, Ben, this investigation that UPMC contracted for, it was an internal report. Why was it an internal report? And why did it come to light?
Well, we don't really know exactly why they hired him. I mean, I think Sean explained some of our theories, but they hired him. Streifel is him. They paid him. We don't know what he was paid. And he issued a report. It just didn't come to light.
But the point is if it shows that there is some blame to be shared, wouldn't UPMC want to sort of share the blame, share the compensation costs in any lawsuit?
One would think so. However, they're still doing business to this day with Paris Linens. We don't know why exactly, but that's what we've been told. And that's speculation, but we know they're doing business together still.
What I was expecting the next step would not, obviously the legal step, and they have done that. That's why it came to light, because the attorneys for the family went to court and said, hey, we want to add Paris Linens as a defendant in this civil lawsuit. UPMC, I wasn't in the courtroom at the time, but I don't believe they opposed that. If they did, they didn't oppose it strenuously, and the judge very quickly added them as a defendant. So they're going to share the cost, at least in Mr. Craig and the other lawsuit.
Shea Duvall's case.
Yeah. But once it came to light, my first question was, did the CDC know about it? And they told us, yes, they did know about it. My second question was, and what are you going to do about it? And they said, well, if the Department of Health for the state comes through and says, hey, take another look, we'll investigate. But right now, we don't think it's worth reinvestigating, because this doesn't necessarily mean that all these patients contracted it from linens, which sounds to some degree contradictory to the report's findings. Called the Department of Health for the state, they issued a similar statement saying, we don't believe there's any reason to reinvestigate. And it makes you wonder what is going on and why they wouldn't at least want to take a second look if the hospital's own investigator found the same mold on linens months later, albeit. I mean, that may be some of it. Causation, time frame. Hey, you know, these guys died a year earlier or 2 years earlier. This doesn't necessarily mean they got it then. But he found this at the facility in Du Bois. He found this in the linens in Montefiore. And it makes you wonder what they would find if they looked at all of UPMC's hospitals and the other 160 hospitals in the state of Pennsylvania that are serviced by Paris.
Well, and that also leads to the question, wouldn't you want to try to, okay, we'll do another investigation, we'll reopen it, and maybe we won't agree, or maybe we will, but wouldn't that also give them some data possibly if this would ever happen again so that they know where to look for and the causation for such a problem? I mean,
it's a great question. We don't know. To piggyback on what Sean was just saying, there is some timing that's interesting. I believe the report from Strifel was May 2nd, 2016, and the CDC came up with their final report May 13th, 2016, 11 days later. No mention of, again, the UPMC report that they commissioned Strifel for.
And what's interesting about the CDC report then, as well as their preliminary report months earlier in late 2015, is their official conclusion is we don't know the source of the mold. And here, UPMC's own investigation says we may have a possible source of the mold. That would seem to be a really important thing to learn and to confirm. Kind of like in Legionnaire's case, what you do in a case like this, you can go and get the animal that you found on the linen and compare it to the animal that you found in the human. You know, talking about the bacteria or the infection here, the mold. And you can do a DNA test. You can take a look at it and see more definitively, hey, is this just a coincidence or are these part of the same group? And, you know, they did that with a few patients at the Legionnaires where they said, boom, yes, it's the exact same bug in the water that we found in the human, same DNA and everything. I don't believe they've done that here. And it'd be interesting to see if they have any intention of doing it. They haven't said yet. But who knows? You know, this case has surprised me at every turn. I hate to keep referring to it, but the Legionnaires case, likewise, these cases take on a life of their own, especially when aggressive attorneys get involved and the families decide to pursue it. The civil case may be where the pressure comes. It'll be interesting to see if the judge gives them some latitude for additional depositions related to this. I'm sure that's one of the requests from the attorneys. You know, are they going to talk to everybody involved? And why wouldn't you take up Andy Strifel's report? And why wouldn't you look into it? Because this would help you understand what happened that led to the deaths of these two men.
Ben, you got a comment from a CDC spokesperson, I believe, earlier this week, and it was sort of begging the question, well, if it were the linens, wouldn't it be more widespread?
Yeah, I think we both got that comment, and we don't know.
I mean, it's a logical question.
Yeah, it is a logical question. We don't know if more people are going to show up with claims. We don't know yet. I think the way the civil lawsuits proceed will be very interesting. I also wanted to point out that there are two lawsuits that have already settled for the exact same amount, $1.35 million apiece. Two families just decided to settle without, you know, proceeding. So there's in total four lawsuits. Two of them have settled.
The second most important story related to that was Ben had an interview with Andy Strifel last week in which Mr. Strifel, kind of stepping outside his relationship to UPMC, said, I would put my money on it being the linens. He repeated what he told me a year and a half ago. And this is the guy who did the investigation. He's reaching some conclusions. He's a noted expert. They hired him because of his expertise. And that was surprising to me that he was willing to go that far given his relationship and his contractual relationship. But he must have felt very strongly about that to make, because his report is fairly dry. His UPMC, CDC, Department of Health are right. The report does not say, oh, because of what I found, I know it was the linens. But outside of his report just looked at, well, I pulled out a linen. I looked at the roof of this building. I found mold. But he's making the jump. In the interview with Ben, he said, I think it's the linens.
We have less than 2 minutes left. And okay. I want to say, do you think, and you've covered this story, do you think that either or both the Department of Health, Pennsylvania Department of Health, and the CDC are keeping an eye on these other suits, especially if they go to trial, in the sense that, okay, whatever comes out, maybe that will spur us to reopen investigations?
It's hard to say. I don't know. I mean, I agree with what Sean said, that the CDC said, if we're invited back, we'll come back and look. But until we are, we're not coming back. And the Department of Health has said, you know, in short, to be curt, no big deal. You know, so it's hard to know.
It would be really rare for a case like this to go to trial. The way the civil process, especially medical malpractice case with the deaths of people like this, typically proceed, not just UPMC, but every other hospital in town and across the country. Their goal is to try to find a way to reach an agreement before you go to trial, because both sides don't want that. For the families, it's traumatic to have to go over this stuff. For the hospitals, they don't want to use a bad pun, they don't want to reveal their dirty laundry either. Right. But that same pressure of not wanting to go to trial could end up revealing other things along the way. Like I said, I'm sure there will be depositions related to this. The people who are involved, Mr. Streifel probably has a request to come and talk already on his desk. That'll be interesting to see. I mean, is UPMC going to put up its people to talk about what happened when they saw this report and why they didn't ask for more investigation from CDC? Because remember, the original request, the way this all started, UPMC knew about these mole cases and went to the Department of Health and said, hey, we need your help. And the way the chain goes, the Department of Health asks CDC to come in. So it could start anywhere along that process, could start the process all over again.
Gentlemen, thank you so much. Ben Schmidt is a reporter for the Tribune Review. Sean Hamill is a reporter for the Post-Gazette. Thanks, gentlemen, for joining us. Governor Wolf uses terminology such as streamlining, efficiency. Coming up, a preview of what his new budget might look like. That's next on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Governor Wolf unveils his budget for 2017-18 Tuesday. He hasn't been free with too many specifics other than no broad-based tax hike, and he wants to streamline government. Let's talk about that and action in the legislature with Katie Meyer, Capitol Bureau Chief for WESA and public radio stations across the state. Welcome, Katie.
Thanks for having me.
Also on the phone from Harrisburg is John Micek, opinion page editor for Penn Live and the Patriot News. Welcome, John.
Hey, thanks to you. Good to be here.
If you have a question or comment, you can tweet us at WESA Confluence. Folks, I spoke with Governor Wolf earlier this week and asked him about the size of the budget, considering the state's structural deficit of up to $3 billion and that revenues in all the major categories are lower than expected: personal income, sales, corporation taxes.
The big issue that I think we're still trying to figure out what's going on is the corporation taxes are way down over last year. So I'm not looking to bridge that gap with revenues. I'm looking to bridge that gap by making government work smarter. I think there are some loopholes that we need to address. But basically, I'm trying to streamline government.
Streamlining was a recurring theme during that conversation, not just the usual terminology used by a Democratic governor. Is this just the reality of the challenge of that structural deficit I alluded to, plus a Republican-controlled legislature? We'll start with you, Katie.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that the reality of Pennsylvania's budget is that we are in debt. This year, our shortfall is over $700 million. And as you mentioned, we've got a structural deficit. So this year, next year, combined of about $3 billion. And we need either to cut spending or raise revenues. I think there's no question about that. The Independent Fiscal Office has said as much. There are a couple big things that we know are, you know, we need to pay into. We know the budget's going to be large because we have large pension payments we need to make. That's one of the big things. And then our Departments of Health and our Department of Human Services, which are being combined now, they are a big drain on resources as well. And that's largely because Pennsylvania's population is old. We have a lot of old folks that pay into public services here. So there's sort of some immutable costs that go along with this budget. And so it'll be very interesting to see how the legislature and the governor come up with a way to deal with that.
John?
No, I think Katie is absolutely right. I mean, the fact that the governor is looking at consolidation of government services, particularly in these two very large, very costly agencies, is about as prime an indicator as you can get of the situation that the state is in right now. So oddly, though, you know, while this is happening in Pennsylvania, other states are banking surpluses. So I'd be curious to see if the governor looks to those other states and looks to the models that they're using to find themselves into the black. I mean, we know that he dropped $1.8 million on a six-week contract with a New York-based consulting firm to help him find cost savings and efficiencies in state government. And they found something to the tune of about $1 billion. And we also understand that a lot of those suggestions, which we've not seen yet, will be worked into the governor's proposal next Tuesday. So it looks like they are quite serious about taking a hard look at the way government does business. That may cheer Republicans because House Majority Leader Dave Reed of Indiana County earlier this year, tail end of last year, talked about what he's called the reinvention of state government as well.
Yeah, and in fact, Governor Wolf used reinvention there. Wolf used terms like reimagine, restructure. Are these words appealing to a Republican legislature?
They're incredibly appealing to Republicans. I think that's been, that's been what our Republican legislature has been banking on for, Wolf's entire administration. And this is the first budget that we've seen. This is now Governor Wolf's third budget. And this is the first one where we've seen him, pledge not to attempt to raise broad-based taxes. In the last two, we saw him try to get a hike in sales taxes, a hike in personal income taxes. And so now he's, switching gears. He is speaking their language, so to speak. So we're going to have to see, how that plays out and whether or not it lasts into the budget negotiations. Because, I'm sure a lot of listeners know we've had some very tense budget standoffs in the past. And a lot of people are skeptical that will be at an end. But again, for all we know, they're on the same page now.
John, I asked the governor several times the size of the budget. I knew he wasn't going to reveal the amount, but just the terminology he was using, the phrasing he was using, whether it would be higher than the current budget that we have, with the fact that we do have the structural deficit that we mentioned, and also, as Katie mentioned, several hundred million in revenue shortfall, do you think it might be more or less about the same than the current $31.5 billion?
Well, as Katie alluded to a moment ago here, there's the question of pension contributions and the exploding unfunded liability in Pennsylvania's public employee pension funds, which is something to the tune of like $70 billion right now. So that will necessitate some sort of increase. There are other fixed costs in education and employee benefits and salaries and that kind of thing. So I would expect some sort of probably nominal increase, but I don't think we're going to see some sort of epic hike in spending. It might end up well being, if not a small increase, then maybe a flat line, I would suspect, but I could be wrong.
Katie, you get the same sense?
I do get the same sense. And again, it's very difficult to predict these things, and I don't want to get ahead of myself, but as John said, we have these big things that we have to pay into. There's federal costs that we're mandated to pay, and then we have to pay into the pension fund. And that's just to keep the pension fund, by the way. That's just to keep employees getting their pensions. We're not paying down those debts yet. We're not there financially. We can't. And then again, paying into health, the Department of Health, Department of Human Services, those are just two big costs for the state. So, I think, like it or not, we're going to see, spending. We're going to have to. Whether or not they can cut that down, I'm not sure.
Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead, John.
I should probably add, that's going to be dependent on what the Trump White House does
as well.
We already had Eugene DePasquale, the state auditor general, and Joe Torsello, the treasurer, warning of downhill costs if the Obamacare rug gets yanked out from underneath the state. The Trump administration is talking about pushing off more costs, perhaps, to the state. So that could end up costing more money, too.
And I've also heard, by the way, to jump in, some Republican lawmakers expressing some optimism that the Trump White House will cut costs to states. And we haven't really seen any indication of that happening in a concrete way, but there's hope out there that that'll happen as well.
Katie referenced earlier the proposed consolidation of four departments, health, human services, aging, and drug and alcohol programs. Let's hear from Sarah Gobley, the Secretary of Policy and Planning.
So essentially, we're breaking down silos. So we're creating new deputies that are taking different programs from different agencies and bringing them together to be run in a more succinct way.
Okay. Now, she didn't mention how much in savings that consolidation might be, but the governor the next day said in that interview with me, maybe about $50 to $60 million. Now, $50 to $60 million, well, it's sort of a drop in the bucket when you're talking about a $30-plus billion budget. How much impact can that truly have?
You're right that $30 million is a drop in the bucket. And he's thrown out various numbers. We haven't really heard a specific estimate for savings yet. What they're saying with this consolidation is that it's going to get rid of redundant services. And so now they have said that they're not going to cut jobs, or if they do, it's going to be very minimal, and they're going to maintain services. So there's been a lot of skepticism about where any savings would actually come from and whether or not it's a good idea to do this. The Wolf administration obviously thinks that this is a very good idea, but there has been quite a bit of pushback.
And John, Senate Democratic Leader Jay Costa said if there are a number of layoffs, several layoffs resulting from this consolidation, it would be very difficult to get through the Democratic caucus. But Wolf really doesn't need any support from his own party probably on such a consolidation.
Yeah, luckily for Governor Wolf, there are so few Democrats to oppose him these days that actually augurs to his advantage. I kid there, but only just. I mean, keep in mind the Republicans have a veto-proof majority in the Senate. They have a substantial majority in the state house. So, you know, while the governor, I'm sure, would want to have his Democratic allies on side with him on this, you know, if he needed to, he could well do an end around.
Okay, folks, in our remaining few minutes, I wanted to get to other stuff that's happening in the legislature or might be coming up. It happens just about every legislative session, a proposal to reform how public schools are funded, property taxes. So what's being proposed this time around, and are the chances any better that there would actually be some action on this? Katie?
Sure. So we saw a group of Democrats, the Democratic senators, coming together this week to call for a special session on pension reform. Now, this sort of move, it sounds interesting, but it's thought by many people to be sort of a symbolic thing. They want to call attention to this. But again, Senate Democrats, you know, they're in a veto-proof, I mean, they're in an extreme minority in the Senate. So they are attempting to call attention to this issue. You know, Democrats and Republicans have very different ways that they would like to deal with this. Democrats tend to side with schools more, and Republicans, on average, you know, side with homeowners. But there's really a lot of across the aisle, you know, agreement and dissent on this issue. So where people stack up on it is not always predicted by party. So will we see this coming up again? Yes, definitely. Will we see a special session? Who's to say? And there is already legislation moving through the legislature. There's one bill. It's Senate Bill 76, which was brought up last session that was defeated in the Senate, but just narrowly, that actually proposes raising sales and income tax to pay into schools instead of property taxes. Now, some schools have, many Democrats have opposed this because it, you know, pays in, it's not necessarily the best solution for schools, they say. But we'll see. I mean, that's something that's already in the works.
I have to ask you, we have about a minute remaining, so quickly, if you would, what other legislative initiatives, actions you'll be keeping your eye on over the next few months? What do you?
I'll look into the crystal ball here and tell you that there's an abortion ban vote that may be coming up in the House next week. I'll be keeping a fairly close eye on. That's a repeat of the 20-week ban that reared its ugly head for a little while there last session, so I'll be paying some pretty close attention to that.
And anything else further out?
It's all budget all the time.
Yeah, that does take number one priority. What about you, Katie? Yeah. What are you keeping an eye on
in the
weeks
ahead?
Yeah,
just like John said, the abortion ban, I think we may see that as early as Monday. Obviously, unemployment compensation funding is going to be an issue that comes up again and again, and we don't know how that's going to play out. There's still opposition to that with the Republicans in the Senate. So, it all goes back to the budget. That's going to be, the combining factor in all this.
A quick follow-up, Katie. The unemployment compensation, House might take action, but is the Senate waiting on some sort of audit on the program itself?
Yes. So the Auditor General, Eugene DePasquale, is conducting an audit. He started a couple of weeks ago on the unemployment compensation system, and that's not expected to be done until April. So the House, or rather the Senate GOP, has reason to delay this until April. And while Democrats hope they do not, it seems likely that that may happen.
Katie Myers, Capitol Bureau Chief for WESA and public radio stations across the state. John Micek is the opinion page editor for Penn Live and the Patriot News. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
Now what's ahead? Well, if you believe Punxsutawney Phil, another 6 weeks of winter. Phil, we're told, saw his shadow yesterday, which means 6 more weeks of winter. But that might not be too bad considering how mild this winter has been. Hey, by the way, The Confluence is now a podcast. You can sign up for it by going to WESA.FM. Click on The Confluence. And for this week, that's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Our engineer is Tom Hurley. The producer of The Confluence is Marcus Charleston. I'm Kevin Gavin. Hope you have a good week of good news.